Madam Chair, my name is Wes Koistra. I am the Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services at the Department of Human Services. The activities I will cover today are children's mental health grants and operations, adult mental health grants and operations, chemical health, state-operated services, including mental health services, Minnesota Sex Offender Program, the Security Hospital, and the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, or commonly referred to as MEDO. I want to mention before starting that our organizational structure does not line up very neatly with the budget structure, and so a lot of our budget activities are dispersed throughout your document.
So if you can just let us know what page we should be on.
Well, actually,
and each time you change, if you could let us know what page to turn to.
Madam Chair, there's an index in the handouts that will also help guide.
In this folder?
I believe so. It should be in the front.
Oh, yes. How nice. Okay.
And my intent is to cover some of the activities that we're involved in these areas, and certainly I will be available to you to answer questions about the budget itself, and I have other staff here that are available as well. I want to begin by saying that there is, as an overview, there's tremendous amount of transition and change occurring in these programs. We are certainly working very hard to develop a community infrastructure for both adults and children in the area of mental health. We are working in both chemical health and mental health to apply disciplines of best practice and evidence-based practice in how treatment is provided. The result of the development of the community infrastructure has been that we are closing mental health units in our regional treatment centers. We've already closed all units in Fergus Falls. We've closed the last remaining unit, mental health unit in St. Peter. We will be closing mental health units in Brainerd and Wilmer probably by this summer. Some of these campuses are being sold. Others are being used for other purposes. We may have some minimal presence on the campus in the future for some specific services, but we are moving very quickly towards a community-based infrastructure for people with mental illness, and we are also in the process of developing 10 behavioral health hospitals to support that infrastructure, 7 of which have already opened, three will be opening in the future. So there is a lot going on in this area. Many of these changes are driven by some common themes. There's significant growth in the demand for mental and chemical health services. There's growing recognition that mental illness and chemical addiction are chronic health care diseases with treatment that is most effective when integrated into the mainstream of the health care delivery system. There's also growing recognition that we need to coordinate and integrate all services. So while we need to integrate mental health care and chemical health care into the health care system, we also need to do a better job of coordinating and integrating healthcare with social services for these individuals. Research and science and technology are improving in these areas, and it is giving us a better understanding of treatment for mental illness and chemical addiction, and we need to take advantage of the growing body of research and apply what we are learning to develop services that focus on treatment methods that are proven to result in better patient outcomes. For both mental and chemical health services, there is a value of providing services as close as possible to the patient's community and family. The expansion of effective community-based care and treatment is, as I mentioned, replacing the facility-based and institutional models that we once relied upon for patient protection. I mentioned in the joint hearing some of the impacts of chemical and mental health in terms of personal, social, and economic cost. I'm going to mention some of those again because I think they're worth repeating. There are 25% of the MFIP, Minnesota Family Investment Plan caregivers, have a serious mental illness. 30% of the adults in the child welfare system have a serious, I'm sorry, 30% of the children in the child welfare system have serious mental health disorders. 70% of the youth in the juvenile justice system have serious mental disorders. 16% of adults in the correction system have mental illness. 60% of persons with serious and persistent mental illness also suffer from chemical dependency. People with serious mental illness, on the average, die 25 years earlier than the general population. This, again, supports the need to bring mental health treatment and chemical health treatment closer to the mainstream of our healthcare delivery system. People with mental illness and chemical addiction are more likely to be homeless, victims of trauma, unemployed, living in poverty, incarcerated, and the list goes on. Mental illness and chemical addiction are the leading causes of productivity loss in the workplace. Congressman Ramstad was in town the other day, and in an interview on NPR mentioned that untreated depression alone costs our nation $70 billion a year. And when you consider all untreated mental illness, the productivity cost reaches $150 billion per year. In terms of public investments in these areas, public-funded mental health services for programs administered or supervised by our department cost roughly $665 million per year. In this figure, I'm including services provided through our state health care programs, General Assistance Medical Care, Minnesota Care, and medical assistance. I'm including costs in county-administered programs and state-operated services mental health programs, excluding the mentally ill and dangerous population, committed population, and the sex offender population. Public-funded chemical health services cost approximately $130 million. Over $100 million of this investment is accounted for by our Consolidated Treatment Fund vendor payments. Most of the public costs go through our Consolidated Treatment Fund. Approximately $11 million in treatment is paid through the prepaid medical assistance program. The remaining investment is for treatment supports and substance abuse prevention efforts. State appropriations for the sex offender program are approximately $60 million per year. The remaining appropriations for state-operated services, including the security hospital, the MEDO program, and the forensics nursing home, exceed $80 million per year. I am going to begin with children's mental health, the grant accounts, and I will be going in the order of the pages of the areas that are listed in your index. My intent, Madam Chair, is to give an overview of the program area and the activities in that program area, and then I can wait after each area and take questions if there's specific budget questions, if that works for you.
Assistant Commissioner, are you planning to take questions about the materials in this purple folder also?
Okay. I'm sorry. The purple folder provides some just general information that I was wanting to make available to the committee. I don't intend to cover it page by page. It's more background material. I'll be referencing some of the information that's in there, but I don't intend to cover it page by page.
Well, if I could just ask a question about it. There are some counties on this map that are shown not in any color. They're white. And I was wondering what that means. Does that mean they don't have any services?
She's looking at the collaborative map.
They're not blue, they're not red, they're not green, they're not yellow.
Madam Chair. Glennis Edwall, Director of the Children's Mental Health Division at DHS. This, I believe you are referring to the map of Family Services and Children's Mental Health Collaboratives.
Yes.
Yes, and the counties that do not, that are not colored, that are white, do not have a collaborative of either sort. It doesn't mean that they don't have services administered through the county or paid through our Minnesota healthcare programs, but they don't have a formal collaborative.
And are there plans for them to be moving in that direction?
Madam Chair, we continue to encourage the local systems to organize in that way, yes.
But we don't know that they have plans to do that.
I don't know of any plans in those counties that are not colored at the moment, no.
Okay, thank you.
Again, the narrative and fiscal pages for children's mental health are referenced in the index. State grants for children's mental health include screening grants for children in the child welfare and juvenile justice system, as well as targeted case management grants to counties to offset a portion of the county cost of these services. Children's mental health services also benefit from federal mental health block grant that is found in the adult mental health grant section of the budget book. In addition, many children receive mental health services through the prepaid medical assistance program. It should also be noted that beginning in state fiscal year 2004, a little over $20 million in existing children's mental health grants were consolidated with other grants to form the Children and Community Support Grant item that was, I believe, already testified to by Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson in previous testimony.
Mr. Koester, do we know when that block grant was formed since that time, how many children's mental health services have been discontinued by the counties?
Madam Chair, at the time that block grant was formed, there was also, I believe, a 25%, if I'm recalling correctly, reduction to the grant. So you can probably assume at least that proportion. But I think that the data that we've received is that children's mental health services, through the consolidation of that grant, actually reduced more than what their share of that 25% would have been. I'm not sure if Dr. Edwall has specific information.
Madam Chair and Mr. Questra, it appears that some services were affected more than others, really depending on whether there was Medicaid reimbursement through Minnesota Healthcare Programs available for some services that had previously been provided by counties. But in areas where that was not the case, particularly, for example, respite care, we do know that the reductions were more significant. For respite care, for example, it looks like it's about 40%.
Well, and we hear at least periodically of the problem of not being able to get in-home services for children, therapeutic services, which I only can assume has to do with the reduction in the block grant also.
Madam Chair, yes, contracted services by counties, largely to home-based providers, also have shown a major decline.
Okay, let's going.
The Children's Mental Health Division has with a staff of about 15, direct state policy for children's mental health services and works with counties, providers, and state health care programs and other child-serving systems like education to implement this policy. I believe about two-thirds of this staff are funded through the general fund, with the remaining funded through federal sources. Our traditional focus in children's mental health has been on children with serious emotional disturbance. This is a combination of psychiatric diagnosis, chronicity, and impact on functioning. This category of need represents about 5% of preschool-aged children and 9% of school-aged children. Our new focus in children's mental health acknowledges that functional impairments can be minimized and or avoided with early identification and appropriate treatment. Services, we are beginning to try to focus services on earlier intervention, and we are trying to support more services for children with emotional disturbance. In state fiscal year 2006, over 42,000 children and adolescents received county or state-financed mental health services. 23,000 of these children received some county service. Nearly two-thirds of these were also enrolled in the Minnesota healthcare programs. 19,000 received services through the Minnesota healthcare programs without county involvement. The point of all this is that while we serve 42,000, only about half of those, in rough terms, are also served through the counties. Others are served only through our Minnesota Care health care program. So the state's responsibilities for children's mental health include the county responsibility, but is also much broader. So when we talk about children's mental health needs, it certainly includes the county group, but it goes beyond that. As far as core services in children's mental health, pediatrics and primary care are the most typical setting for receiving mental health care and are not typically reflected in general mental health statistics. I believe that there are 60% of the children and adolescents receiving psychotropic medication prescriptions through their primary care physician without any involvement with mental health professionals or psychiatrists. Clinical mental health services are also provided. This is a continuum from outpatient to community-based rehabilitative services to crisis services, day treatment, partial hospitalization, residential treatment, and inpatient hospitalization. Case management is the most typical service to be provided by the county in its role as the local mental health authority. The county is also responsible for assuring available infrastructure of services. Let me mention here that our case management is primarily supported by targeted case management funding that is through MA. We are currently in a state of flux with respect to the stability of that financing. New rules are expected out. We are anticipating that those new rules will reduce federal revenues in the area of targeted case management, but again, the final rules are not out. I believe that you will see a budget page later when we go through the budget pages with you that provides some stopgap funding in the event that the federal rules result in a loss of revenues for counties in the area of targeted case management. I want to mention, too, that there's also been a great deal of interagency coordination. Minnesota has established a system of family services and children's mental health collaboratives, which, Madam Chair, you were referencing the map earlier, to assure coordination across child living services. We have also suffered loss of federal funds in this area as well, I believe, in an annual amount of about $40 million, which is, I believe, correct me, Dr. Edwell, I believe is around 87% of the funding. I may be wrong. In that figure. So we are taking two steps forward and two steps backwards in the area of financing children's mental health services. Children's mental health service involves many other children's services that are not necessarily centered in the Department of Human Services. Coordination with education, as you would imagine, is particularly crucial. The overlap with special education is substantial. The school setting presents challenges for children that are similar to how employment creates challenges for adults. As mentioned earlier, there is a high proportion of mental health diagnoses in the child welfare population, but not the reverse. Families may need other county services, such as respite care and crisis services, like we have already mentioned. I've also mentioned the prevalence of mental health issues among juvenile justice. While 70% of children in juvenile justice have at least one mental health diagnosis, it's important to note that most have more than one, and most also have chemical health problems as well. I want to mention that we've begun meetings with the Department of Corrections and Commissioner Fabian on how we can work better together in dealing with the mental health issues and chemical health issues in the juvenile justice system. It's a real critical issue given the statistics that I just mentioned. There are also significant cultural and ethnic disparities in our juvenile justice population, which may in part be related to poor access to services when these children were young. Our current priorities for children's mental health are early identification of mental health problems and early and effective intervention, improving access to services, which is difficult in light of the recent funding reductions and the threatened funding reductions, and to ensure better quality and better outcomes for children with mental health issues. Our recent accomplishments include improving access and quality of mental health care and primary care. We have one project that is funded through a grant called the ABCD2 Project, where we're working with children's hospitals and clinics, as well as CentraCare, that focuses on the value and the improvements that can be made to treatment through co-location of primary care and mental health professionals. We also have developed a number of quality improvements to the system, including piloting outcome measures in 31 counties. We have introduced the Hawaii database to infuse research evidence throughout clinical practice. The Hawaii database is a comprehensive database that has taken the research in children's mental health treatment and put it into one place where clinicians can access, and based upon the demographics and the condition and the diagnoses of the child, it can say, these are the things that work for this child, and these are the things that have proven not to work for this child, and will certainly provide great information to clinicians as they seek the best possible treatment course. We've also created standards for service provision and documentation. These quality efforts extend beyond the public system. We have partnerships with health plans that are applying these quality measures to their commercial book of business as well. The challenges in children's mental health, of course, include the decrease in spending for children's mental health that has particularly affected contract services and respite care, as we've already mentioned, the dramatic reductions in primary funding source, the local collaborative time study money that was funding the collaboratives, the potential Medicaid changes that we've mentioned in terms of targeted case management, And also they're looking at the rehabilitative option that we fund a lot of services through as well. And we have significant provider shortages, including psychiatry, child psychology, culturally specific providers, and providers who are able to treat low incident conditions. And finally, a major challenge for us is the fragmentation of the financing and policy structures within children's mental health. I think it's fair to say that we've cobbled together a system through opportunities that have been in front of us, and we hope as we go through our budget proposals, we can talk about some changes that we believe will make more sense in terms of delivering an understandable financing structure and policy for children's mental health as we go forward. I'm going to move to adult mental health unless there are questions with respect to those budget pages.
So we've been on page 73C, is that correct?
Right, and the children's mental health grants, those are the grants, 73C, and I think on there is the screening grants as well as the targeted case management grants we use to offset the non-federal share for counties.
Right.
And so then the mental health administration is kind of buried in a larger administrative area of Children and Family Services Administration found on page 101 and 102B.
Okay, but we're going to stick to 73C right now for questions. And I'd like to ask the first question in regard to the children's mental health screening grants. How many of the children that are screened, did you say, are found to have a mental health condition? These are children that are either entering our child welfare system or our juvenile correction system.
Madam Chair, we are not allowed to collect that data directly at the state because of a particular clause that was in the bill with regard to screening, and so we need to look to our county partners to provide us that information. What we are hearing from counties is that there is some range in what they are finding in their juvenile justice and child welfare populations. Where those populations are the most dramatically affected by poverty, for example, estimates that we get from Ramsey County, we're probably seeing about 50% of the child welfare population and upwards of 70% of the juvenile justice population screening positively.
And then what happens after they're screened? Are there automatically services available?
Madam Chair, the structure of the program under the legislation that was passed is that a positive screen results in a referral for a diagnostic assessment. That diagnostic assessment is to be paid for by Minnesota healthcare programs or private insurance if available, or there was an appropriation to cover that service for children who were uninsured or underinsured. Similarly, there was a sufficient appropriation to cover brief therapeutic interventions for those children. So there's a structure, and to the best of our knowledge in monitoring the performance of counties, we are getting the diagnostic assessments. It seems to be a much more of a challenge to get the monies to stretch far enough to actually cover services afterwards.
Well, I think that's a concern.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I think the reason for providing the screening was to see if services to those children would result in they're not being a part of the juvenile justice system or not needing an out-of-home placement. And I think it's kind of hard for us to assess that and follow it up if we are not able to collect the data or get information about it. So I guess I'm just indicating that I see that as a shortcoming in that particular program that maybe needs to be addressed.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
On the children's targeted case management, will the federal cuts also affect us in that area since we have taken over the state federal share of that type of case management?
Madam Chair, the federal reductions in targeted case management are generated by changes in policy and what can be billed and what can't be billed. And every indication is that while we haven't received the final rules, that this is going to be significant. And I think that all payers of targeted case management are going to lose the value of a significant amount of federal revenue in this area. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question directly.
Do we know how much our state budget will be affected?
At this time, we don't. I think we can only look at the experience of other states. I believe Massachusetts experienced about 85% loss, 85 to 90% loss in their federal revenues in targeted case management. But they have done an audit of our program. We have not received the final results of that audit from the federal government. It appeared they were applying the same criteria. We don't know that our approach to case management was appreciably different than Massachusetts' approach to case management. So, our expectation of loss is kind of based upon what we're seeing happening in other areas right now.
And this was only budgeted for 06 and 07?
Yeah,
I see. The funds are in the forecast for 08 and 09?
Yes, yeah.
But the forecast is not anticipating any federal reduction in funding?
Madam Chair, that's correct, because we haven't received final determination of audit, nor we've received final rules, and we do not typically forecast a change until either the audit findings are released or rule changes are made.
Would it be a fair assumption that the forecasted amount is similar to the amounts that are shown for 06 and 07?
Madam Chair, I think there's some growth occurring in targeted case management. I assume it's going to be similar, and I think it's an assumption in our budget when we provided the stopgap funds that we're expecting to see the significant reductions, but it's just not showing up in the forecast yet. I'm not sure if Ms. Don Allen, who does our legislation and fiscal work in our area, may has more specific information about what's contained in the MA forecast.
Madam Chair, Don Allen, Chemical and Mental Health Services. The total amount of targeted case management mental health funding is about $70 million a year. And the federal share then is $35 million roughly. And that flows directly through two counties and county contracted providers. The grants that are on this page reflect kind of a historical artifact. Back in the 90s, mental health targeted case management was billed on a unit basis. It was kind of clumsy. And these grants, it was transferred over to a model that matched what was done in the child welfare area, where the federal funds were matching a certified public expenditure by the counties. And the grants that are on this page are a remnant of what was the state share back at that time. Those grants are adjusted annually on a caseload basis. And so as targeted case management has grown, these grants have also grown. If counties lose funding for targeted case management, it's reasonable to assume that those caseloads will also go down. And so these grants may well turn downward in the future, if that's the case. And that'll be a forecasted item. At the moment, the growth has been slowing, but they have not turned downward.
So would we assume then that maybe we would lose 80% of this amount?
Madam Chair, I think that it's reasonable to fear that. I don't know whether we can assume anything. I think that's the experience that we're seeing from other states. And again, that's basically what we can base that experience from. And when the federal auditors were here, we did not learn anything differently from that we should not be looking at what happened in Massachusetts and what's happening in other states as well. I think one important point is that Mr. Allen made is that the forecast will show growth in these grants, final federal determination could change that forecast fairly dramatically.
Well, I guess the reason I'm asking the questions about this is because it has always seemed to me like we get a lot of attention focused on when the counties are potentially losing federal funding, to the extent that we sometimes don't pay attention to when we are losing federal funding at the state level. And so if this is an area where we are potentially losing federal funding, I don't believe the governor's budget is making this up in
Madam
his
Chair,
recommendations.
In the I believe in the governor's budget, and I don't have that page in front of me. It's making part of it up. It's not making the whole anticipated loss up. But again, anticipated loss is rather difficult to identify without the final rules. There's also a lot of discussions from states directed towards lawmakers in Washington about trying to correct the direction of this, and so I really don't know what I can't predict what the federal government's going to finally do.
My understanding, and of course we will get to that after we finish the base budget, but my understanding was that it was to cover for, on a one-time basis, loss of targeted case management dollars in the out-of-home placement area, as well as the adult mental health, as well as the children's mental health area. So it was not specifically going to make up any of the funds that we would be losing that would be otherwise available for state grants or state funding.
Madam Chair.
You can check on that so that when you present that page to us, we would understand that better.
Madam Chair, if I could just clarify that the loss of federal funding through the targeted case or the regulations governing targeted case management, that the counties bear the risk for that. The money is passed through the department to the counties at this time, all that federal funding. And it does not impact our state operations or our grants. These grants that are on this page are state general fund grants, and they're adjusted on client caseloads. And so if client caseloads go down as a result in the available funding at the county level, then these grants would also be adjusted downward. There is no any risk worth mentioning about state budget impact on resulting from the changes in targeted case management, except to the extent that which the state chooses to mitigate those losses at the county level.
Well, these grants are to cover the state share of the Medicaid portion of the targeted case management. So if we lose the federal share, we've lost part of the value of this grant money.
Yeah. Madam Chair, let me take a stab at the nuance here. These grants go to counties to offset their cost for the non-federal share of targeted case management. They will continue to go to counties regardless of whether there is a loss in the federal share or not, to the extent that the caseloads remain the same. They will be reduced if they go down. But my understanding, and I'm certainly welcome to be corrected by Mr. Allen, is that all of the revenue generation occurs through the county expenditure. We're just offsetting their cost with these grants.
So these grants make up the difference between the MA payment and the actual cost of doing targeted case management for children?
Madam Chair, they do not quite make that up. It was a historical deal that was cut back in the 90s, as you will. The state was going to be responsible for growth in caseload, and so these adjusted purely on caseload. The counties were going to bear the risk for growth in unit cost, as you were. So
okay.
We do not replace all of the counties' non-federal
share. So all this does is take over the caseload growth from a specific point in time. So we're paying for that growth. We're paying the state share for the cost of the targeted case management for a certain number of cases that have increased since some point in time in the past.
I'm sure that's correct.
Okay. All right. Well, I just think that we need to pay attention to this area, because if we are in the future potentially losing money, we need to be aware of that. And I'm not too thrilled about the fact that this is now just forecasted and doesn't show up on a page where we can track it. So that if we are losing those funds, it's going to be hard for us to see it in our budgeting process here.
Madam Chair, we can certainly give you the value that is now held in the MA forecast of these dollars going out, if that would be helpful to you, and certainly report if there is a change in our forecast based upon final federal rules, how that affects this. We'll make sure that we follow up with that.
Thank you. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner Kuster and Madam Chair. I'm wondering, we're talking about a potential 85 to 90% loss of the federal funding of a $70 million program. Are the counties going to even continue to bother with all the paperwork and the requirements of maintaining a targeted case management system with a loss this massive? I mean, I'm just wondering, if they're going to.
Senator Lori, what is the alternative?
I don't know what the alternative is.
Well,
that's
the alternative would be to place children in foster care, which costs money also.
That's kind of where I'm getting. I'm trying to continue this. I mean, somebody's going to have to step up to the plates if the feds, because, I mean, let me just, the 80 to 90% reduction is on the $35 million federal financial share that we're talking about here, and somebody's going to have to be ready to step up to the plate. It sounds like, I don't know if these services
are. Well, it's definitely going to have a financial impact on our state.
Right.
It's, you know, the children don't go away.
No, they do not.
Just one comment also, these children's mental health crisis grants, where is the outstate grant being provided?
Madam Chair, Director Glenna Sedwell tells me that the outstate grant will be offered under an RFP next year. We started with the metro area.
I see.
I can tell you what they're not being provided. They just closed a crisis nursery in Redway.
Okay, so that RFP is just going out, and we don't know who will be receiving it.
Correct.
I just do want to point out that this grant was to be funded through the Healthcare Access Fund on a one-time basis only. It was one of the few things we could get the House to agree to fund last year. And the only funding available by the time they agreed to it was the Healthcare Access Fund money. So it's a pilot that's starting up on a one-time basis. And so that if we're going to continue those grants in the future, it would have to come out of the general fund. Any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I just want to see if I'm understanding correctly by paraphrasing what you're saying, and maybe I misunderstood, but I know that this is an area that's been receiving a lot of attention in my district, as I'm sure it is around the state. Is what you're saying is that based on what you're projecting is likely to happen, the flow through federal dollars to the county are likely to be decreased substantially, which will then force them to lower their caseload because they won't have as much money, which will then trigger less money coming from the state as well. So there's kind of a double loss of funds to the counties under the scenario that you're predicting.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think that in general terms that would be correct because the basis of our grants to counties is determined by caseload. I think that if we lost federal funds, we will see reductions in case management caseloads. There's certainly some legal obligation of the counties to continue to provide case management. How selective they can be under that legal obligation is something that needs to be looked at. But let's just assume that behavior is typical, and when you lose financing for something, you reduce service. That means that the basis of this grant would also go down, and they would lose some dollars there. Although I think it's also important to note that compared to the $35 million that is on the table for mental health targeted case management and federal revenues, that's the big issue. This is $5 million compared to that thirty-five. So, I'm not trying to dismiss the issue that we would lose some forecasted grants for counties under that, but it's dwarfed by the loss of federal funds in that area. But you're right; it's both.
Assistant Commissioner, how many children that have mental health services are in our managed care programs where we're able to protect the case management dollars?
I believe there was about 19. Wait, I'm sorry, just a minute. I think there's, I have that. About 23,000 children are participating in our health care programs that receive mental health services.
And then how many are there that are receiving services that are not in our managed care programs?
That would leave probably about 19,000.
So it's about half and half. And is it possible for us somehow to get the other children into the managed care programs so that we can save their case management dollars?
Madam Chair, certainly there are current opt-out provisions for PMAP. I believe there's about 3,000 children that are not in the PMAP program because they choose not to be. Those opt-outs typically are concentrated in specific counties, so there's a lot of influence at the county level, it appears, on who opts out of the prepaid medical assistance program. I think also the delivery of the development of benefit sets in the improvement of benefit sets in our mental health programs also will improve participation as well. So there are some ways that we think that we can improve participation in those programs, and as you're suggesting, continue to deliver care coordination and case management services from that angle.
Are there other questions on this page? If not, let's go on then.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'm going to move to adult mental health services. I believe the grant section for adult mental health begins on page 180. There's the adult mental health division has about 24 staff. Again, I believe about two-thirds of these staff are funded through the general fund and a third are funded through federal sources. And these staff are responsible for state policy for adult mental health services and work with counties, providers, state health care programs, and other systems like economic assistance, housing authority, and corrections to implement this policy. The Minnesota adult mental health system is guided by a commitment to recovery. This calls for a person-centered, strength-based system that enables a person to live a meaningful life in the community while working to achieve their full potential. Our emphasis in adult mental health is upon the delivery of services that produce sound clinical outcomes. Our priorities include the development of recovery-based service delivery system as part of healthcare, as we've emphasized previously, access to quality services, providing the right services at the right amount at the right time, implementing evidence-based practices that produce sound client outcomes, and maintaining and strengthening services for those with serious mental illnesses while supporting and developing earlier intervention strategies. Like any healthcare condition, mental illness benefits, treatment of mental illness benefits by early treatment. It's no different than other diseases of the body. The target population and prevalence, there are about 211,000 adults who have serious mental illness. About 77,000 have serious and persistent mental illness. About 60,000 adults receive at least one service in the public system. Again, I believe, like children's mental health, the number of people receiving services through the county are about half of those that receive some mental health services through the state and county. For many public-funded services, the county administers services as the local mental health authority and either provides or contracts with providers for services. Since 1996, planning for and the selected service delivery has been provided through 16 adult mental health initiatives. There is a map in your handout that you can refer to either now or later. These began in 1995 and went statewide in 1996. Again, similar to children's mental health, there are many adults who receive mental health services through our public-funded health care programs but do not receive services from the county. In terms of core services, the public-funded service system has traditionally provided clinic-based services such as psychotherapy, partial hospitalization, medication management, and day treatment. Recently, there has been tremendous growth in the development of community services that are evidence-based. The development of adult mental health initiatives in 1995 has been critical to improving the community service infrastructure, but growth in service options since 2002 has been unprecedented. These services include rehabilitative services such as adult rehabilitative mental health services. These are community support services that assist in daily living skills, symptom reduction that is important both to their daily living and to their employment. Assertive community treatment teams. These are services that have low caseloads with across a number of professionals and clinicians who provide intensive intervention in the community. Some individuals refer to this as a hospital without walls. We also provide intensive residential. We have seen growth in intensive residential treatment services. These are sub-acute care services for individuals who do not require acute care hospitalization but do require some out-of-home placement for stability. Typically, services are authorized for up to 90 days. They can be authorized for longer than that if it is necessary to meet the client needs, and then also crisis response services. To give you an idea of the growth of the community-based infrastructure, since 2002, there are 112 ARMS providers have been developed serving over 11,000 clients. 20-plus crisis providers have been developed serving over 3,200 clients per year. 26 ACT teams are serving over 1,700 clients per year. 32 of the intensive residential treatment services are now serving 1,800 individuals per year. Targeted mental health case management that we provide through a brokered services model serves approximately 21,000 clients per year. We've also expanded the use of our home and community-based waiver, the CADI waiver, which is used for individuals who are at risk at nursing home placement, is now serving over 3,000 clients with mental illness. All this community-based service growth has occurred again since 2002. We've also expanded community-based hospital care. We have 17 contract bed hospitals. These are hospitals that we contract with to provide services to MA clients. I want to emphasize it does not expand the number of beds in our hospital system. It just makes those beds more accessible to the public client. We have also developed 10 16-bed state-operated community-based community behavioral health hospitals. I should say we are developing 10. So far, seven have been developed, and we anticipate the other three to open by the end of the summer. This is a great success as a community-based alternative. This has been a great success as a community-based alternative to our RTC model. I want to mention that the community-based behavioral hospitals that are operated by state-operated services are showing an average length of stay of less than 25 days. Our contracted beds have an average length of stay of about 28 days, while our remaining long-term regional treatment center in Anoka has an average length of stay of about 90 days. So as you can see, as we move towards a community-based model for providing inpatient care, it becomes much more like you would anticipate from hospital, of what you would anticipate out of hospital care, and much less long-term residential placement that is necessary for lack of community-based services.
And Assistant Commissioner Koister, I think the other important thing for members of the committee to remember is that when we fund our mental health services through a community-based model, we get federal matching dollars on those funds, whereas we do not get federal matching dollars for our regional treatment center services.
Madam Chair, if I could just expound a minute on that important point. We were anticipating, I believe, unpaid services in our community-based hospitals of about 10%. We get no matching dollars, as Madam Chair mentioned earlier, in our regional treatment centers. I think our longest opened behavioral health hospitals are now looking somewhere around 3% of services that are not funded through third-party payers or MA. So it's been, even in that regard, it's been the success of these has exceeded what our original expectations were. In addition to these services, we also provide and partner in the provision of a number of other support services. Within terms of competitive and extended employment services, these are administered through an interagency agreement between our agency and DEED. We also work with the MHFA to provide Bridges funding, which is temporary rental subsidy that is delivered to people with mental illness who are eligible for a Section 8 certificate but are not yet receiving that assistance. We also provide crisis housing services that help retain housing for individuals who are hospitalized for up to 90 days and have no other source of funds. Often a person with mental illness who needs to be hospitalized ends up losing their housing while they're being hospitalized because then they can no longer pay for the rent during that period of time. So this assistance helps them in that. We also fund drop-in centers, often run by consumers, for social and recreational activities. Other activities include we have a Johnson & Johnson grant for a supportive employment grant. We're one of 11 states to implement evidence-based principles in supportive employment settings, and this is starting in 4 pilot projects. It's a 4-year project with $280,000 in funding. We're also working with Continuing Care on the demonstration to maintain independence in employment. This is a federal demonstration grant, I believe, of almost $50 million that provides a comprehensive set of health and mental health services and employment supports to assist people with serious mental illness so they can maintain their employment. This will also prevent them from becoming disabled. There's also a 3-year federal grant that we just received from SAMHSA to develop an integrated dual disorder treatment system across the state. This is to better deliver care for individuals who have both mental illness and a chemical dependency. This is a $3.5 million grant over 3 years. We also have pilot projects in place with the Southeast Asian and Somali communities to better serve those communities in terms of mental health services. Cultural competency is a big issue that we have to wrestle with in this state in terms of delivery of both chemical and mental health services. And we're working in collaboration with MHFA and other key stakeholders to address the needs of the long-term homelessness. The challenges in this area are still many. Even though we've done a lot in terms of developing a community-based infrastructure, we have a long way to go. Certainly, I think we've done quite well in outstate Minnesota, in the greater Minnesota. The success is being proven by the short lengths of stay in our community behavioral health hospitals, but we have tremendous infrastructure needs still in the metro area and still in some parts of greater Minnesota. We need to better coordinate and integrate mental health care with physical health care. We need to continue the development of the range of employment and housing options. Certainly, housing is a big issue in the metro area and some greater Minnesota areas as far as our ability to avoid unnecessary hospitalization. We need to address, like in children's mental health, the shortage of mental health professionals, especially psychiatrists. It does us no good to have hospital beds when they're not serviced. It does us no good to develop community-based services when there's not the clinicians there to provide the service. Again, we need to develop culturally competent service capacity. We need to develop mechanisms to better measure outcomes and performance. And we need to develop a public financing structure that, like children's mental health, has been cobbled together, and we need one that is easy to understand and that supports the provision of treatment in the right place, time, and location. That's the overview of adult mental health. Again, the grant pages, I believe, begin on 180 and continue through 182 in the following
letters. Other questions? Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I'm wondering, the line that somebody would call, what's it called for if they're calling to find a bed for somebody that they've, let's say the police department has picked somebody up and it's clear that there's mental health issues and they're trying to find a bed. Is there a number that they call?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring. We have for state-operated services bed a 24-hour line that's available to be called currently. We have been moved towards that with the onset of the behavioral health hospital beds in the community, and we're still developing that. I think it's available, and we're still making improvements to it. But I think that we've got some of the bugs out, and I think it's going pretty well. So there's now just one line to call. Let me also mention that we received funding last year in the budget for a hospital bed tracking system, and we've been working with the Hospital Association to develop that, and that is basically available to say when someone needs hospital care, where are the hospital beds that are currently available. Not only do we have a problem in the availability, we have a problem in knowing where they are. And so this is a tracking system that will help us know where available psychiatric hospital bed capacity is located, and that's due to begin, I believe, in April.
And, Madam Chair, if I could just follow up. I would just make you aware that I did have a meeting with some hospital people last night, and they informed me, and they're going to forward on their concerns that this line is not working. They're having some problems finding beds. And is it my understanding that you're going to have a website or somewhere online where you can go and they can specifically find where there's a bed available? Because the line is not necessarily, you know, I don't think all the bugs are out of it yet. And so, you know, it's a concern. And I, as soon as I have this information from them, I would certainly forward it on to you so that we can get things running smoothly.
Senator Coring, is it the one that's starting in April that they're having trouble with?
No, I think it's the one that's currently up and
for the regional treatment centers?
Right.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, that would be great to get that information because we want it to work well for people. So we welcome getting whatever feedback we can get.
And then, Madam Chair, are you going to Commissioner, are you going to have some kind of a website where they can go on to see where they can kind of locate a bed? Let's say they're in Wadena and the 16-bed unit is full there. Are they going to be able to see if there's something available in Brainerd or Bemidji or wherever? Or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, the web access to beds, or that, I believe that is referring to the broader system of psychiatric bed tracking that will not only include state-operated services, hospital beds, but also include other psychiatric bed capacity that's available through private hospitals as well.
So that'll be part of what comes up in April?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. So we're getting there. Maybe.
Okay.
You know, we had quite a hard time getting the House to agree to any of these new programs that we're starting this year, so hopefully we'll have a better time with them this year.
That would be nice.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Commissioner, I have a series of questions. Just to follow up on the what my experience in Mankato is that there is a very high, I don't know if this is current, but within the last several years, a 70% turnaway rate at the emergency room because of the inpatient beds being filled or red, what we call red flag, because there's not access to psychiatrists. And as a result of that, there's this search to find available beds throughout the state of Minnesota, and it means the outcome of this is that somebody from Duluth is shipped to Mankato if there's a bed there, and if somebody's in Mankato, they're shipped to some other part of the state because the beds are not available locally. So you can have your community hospital that has psychiatric beds having patients being transferred in from all over the state, and then patients in your local area are transferred someone else. So I think there's a significant problem in the area of acute care, and that there needs to be some solutions. I don't think the motivation is there. I think that this effort to reduce the number of inpatient hospital beds because of their expense, of course, and to move to community-based mental health services is important, but we have to take a look at what's happening in the acute care situation. It is appalling, and I think that there's an expense associated with this that's not being calculated, and I wonder what your reaction is to that.
Madam Chair,
Assistant Commissioner.
Senator Sharon, the issue of the emergency department capacity and the psychiatric bed capacity is extremely serious within the metro area and even some parts outstate. We've been working with the hospital, with the hospitals in tracking bed flow. We did a study of patient flow, and individuals that participated in that study concluded that the issues around psychiatric bed demand, you would think maybe the solution would be more beds. The solution tends to be we need more community services, because what they're finding out is there's a number of individuals where hospitalization could be avoided if appropriate community service was delivered. There's also a number of individuals who are in hospitals who are ready for discharge, but there's no community service to discharge them to. So I want to make that important note. I would also note that much of the demand in psychiatric hospitals is not necessarily demand by public clients. It's demand by clients who are outside the public system, who may be insured through commercial products. And this also points to the issue of needing to provide better mental health treatment earlier on in the onset of the illness. When we have an opportunity to talk about our mental health initiative, we are making tremendous investments in the community mental health infrastructure in proposing to make in crisis services and additional ERTs, intensive residential treatment services, subacute care, and so forth, that we think will certainly assist with this. We have done a good job in the outstate area generally. I know there's concerns about metro clients being referred to outstate hospitals. I understand that. We've done a good job, and we've done it through the development of community-based services. So one of my greatest concerns in this discussion is that the logical conclusion would seem to be more hospital beds, when really the conclusion that even hospital officials reach and that we've reached is we need more community-based services to prevent hospitalization and have people come out. Another example of that is that in Anoka, we typically have a waiting list of 40 individuals to be admitted. We will admit anyone who is not in a hospital bed and needs hospital services, but that waiting list is primarily people who are in other hospital beds. We have a waiting list of about 70 to be discharged, who are ready for discharge. That tells you that if we can get the community-based services in place for individuals who are ready to leave hospital care, we've solved the Anoka waiting list problem. And I think that's true for other hospitals as well. It's a really important issue.
And I think, Senator Sharon, that as time goes on, we'll be having a discussion of various mental health proposals, including the bill that the governor has proposed in conjunction with the Mental Health Action Group. And I think one of the conversations that we need to have somewhere along the line in relationship to that is, if we expand our array of services in all of our public programs, then will the private health plans do likewise and include those services as a service for commercially insured patients as well? I'm talking about services like ACT teams. I'm talking about services like ERTS step-down hospitals. I'm talking about services like case management, And I'm talking about services like rehab option services. If we could get those across the board, not only in our public programs, but in our private insurance also, I think it would do a great deal to alleviate the kind of problems that you're describing. Because if you have an ACT team, oftentimes you can avoid a hospitalization.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, I agree with the issues around the community-based services that need to be provided. I do not believe that I think a lot of the motivation in some of the dialogue about the need for inpatient beds is around economics. And the economics, certainly, prevention is always the best approach. And what I'm talking about is not an argument against that. All of these services need to be expanded. But we need, the patients need acute inpatient care. Seriously, psychiatric patients. And some of those patients can move very rapidly into a psychiatric crisis so that even with case management, you're not able to avoid an escalation in a manic depressive disorder. A second issue I want to talk about, though, is that I have not heard you mention when we're talking about being able to provide some of the early intervention where you can get somebody engaged in a clinical process, in a clinical intervention. Earlier in the stage, that when we talk about the shortages of service providers, that you're not talking about the shortage of clinical nurse specialists who have the capacity to prescribe medication and who have the capacity within an already approved scope of practice to intervene early with patients because of that expanded scope of practice, and that there clearly needs to be work, and I'm interested to know what work there is being done to support the utilization of alternatives to psychiatrists for the service early intervention.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I think we'll have an opportunity to talk about this in depth when we go through the mental health proposal that we've been referencing, because we do provide increased payment rates for a number of professionals in that proposal, because we recognize that access is an issue. I'm not aware of specific practice approaches. I know that generally what we're seeing, and I want to get back to your first point with respect to the economics of providing mental health services. We just met with a number of care systems individually, including Park Nicollet, CentraCare, St. Mary's in Duluth, and others, and Health East, Alina, and so forth. And each one of them talked about mental health services as being a loss leader.
That's right.
In their service delivery system.
And one of the things that we need to understand is that part of that, a large part of that, is due to the rules of Medicare payment. Last session, for example, we did increase payments to some mental health providers, but we were not able to do that for any of our dual eligible clients because Medicare will not allow under fee-for-service for us to pay more than Medicare pays. And so it gets to be kind of complicated. I think there are some opportunities that the state might have to enter into pilot projects that would allow us more flexibility in the Medicare payment system. And I think as time goes on, we need to get more information about those so that we don't miss out on any opportunity we have for kind of addressing the root of the problem here, which is partly the Medicare payment system. Are there other questions on this on these pages about adult services? Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, bringing you back to the statement you made about the length of stay in a local treatment facility being shortened and that being used as a measure of the success of that kind of program as compared to a regional treatment center. I'm wondering when we get into the further discussions if we could be looking at something other than just the length of stay in a hospital, for example, as a measure of success. For example, how likely is that person to have a need for rehospitalization within the next year? Because there are just shortening the stay by itself isn't necessarily a measure of how successful that person was being treated, in my opinion. And I'd like to see some further evidence of whether this is successful.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's exactly the kind of issue we're working on in developing an outcome, the outcome and performance measurement system. I mentioned length of stay is because we've had so many problems with average length of stay in institutional settings where individuals are placed there and left there even after they've stabilized. You're right. I've also read articles where length of stays have been reduced to 4 days, and that's not good for the client. So I'm not suggesting that length of stay is an only measure, but when you compare 20 days or 28 days to 90 days, when almost all individuals stabilize in with respect to their acute hospital care needs before within 30, most within 30, most almost all before 60, we know that people are there for other reasons than hospitalization. But we're looking at issues of reentry into of being hospitalized again over a certain period of time. Those are the kind of measures that we want to use to really evaluate the performance of our care system. You're absolutely right.
One more question.
Other questions? Senator Sharon.
That was another one of my questions. I didn't want to dominate too much, so I appreciate your asking that question. I have another question to ask you to go back, Commissioner, to a statement that I didn't quite understand. You were talking in the Children's Mental Health Services about a resource that's being funded. Hawaii was the state that you referred to, and it was about being able to access best practices that have been demonstrated to have an impact, positive impact on outcomes. And that if you follow a cluster, if I understood what you were saying, a cluster of scientifically supported practices to deal with a particular issue, you had a positive outcome. Would you say more about that? Say what the state's role is in developing that, and who has access to that?
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator, the Hawaii model database was a product that originated in Hawaii and originated out of a court decree because of poor services that were being delivered. And I'm going to ask for Dr. Edwall's help if I run astray in the information I give you. But my understanding of this is that it is the development of it. We are working on this through a grant and participating with the development of a database that provides all the information and research that has been available for treatment of children's mental health. So that in the end, a clinician can go to the database and say, I have a 12-year-old, he is African-American, he has this diagnoses, he has these other demographic factors around him, and it'll bring up the research and the studies for treatment that have been proven to be effective and those that have proven to be not effective in that case. It doesn't tell the clinician what to do. It gives clinician good choices among the practices that are available. And I'm going to ask Dr. Edwall to tell you where we're at in the use of this database at this point, because I know she would be really excited to tell you about it.
Senator Sharon, Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner Koistra outlined, this database was developed in the state of Hawaii under a consent decree. It existed on the mainframe computer in the state of Hawaii for a long time and was beginning to outgrow it. It was about at that point that we became involved with Hawaii, and with the support of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, we have developed a web-based front end that allows access to the database, and then have also cooperated in cross-validating all of the studies that are in it. So we have right now, and this is why I'm so excited, we have the most comprehensive set of information culled from the research that is available anywhere in the system right now. Putting it into a web-based system means, obviously, we have a lot of testing to do to make sure it works the way we want it to. And so we have pilot sites that are funded by our CMS grant here in the metropolitan area. And then we have, in the last year, been very fortunate also to obtain two large SAMHSA system of care grants in the state, one in northwestern Minnesota and one in central Minnesota, and have written in use of the Hawaii database into those system of care contracts. And so we are beginning to train and to pilot also in those two large areas in central and northwest Minnesota. We're also delighted that Health Partners, in their case management system, which is a relatively small program within their system, but nonetheless for their highest need kids, have also been piloting with us using the outcome measures that we're introducing and then using access by the case managers to the Hawaii database to create treatment plans for these kids. So we have a 3 to 5 year plan to roll this out everywhere statewide, but we're at about that stage in the pilots right now.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, then let's move on.
Okay. Madam Chair, the next area is chemical health. And
for those of you that came in a little bit later, in your purple packet, there's sort of an outline of the pages that we're going to be doing because they're scattered throughout the book.
Great.
So if you look for that in your purple packet, then you can follow and look under Chemical Dependency Entitlement Grants, page 200. And then you can just keep following this as we go through the presentation. All right. Assistant Commissioner Koistra.
Okay. Madam Chair, medical experts today generally consider alcohol and other dependence to be a disease like mental illness that, while treatable, is chronic and relapsing. It is also known that there's a strong genetic factor that contributes to substance addiction. I point this out because in our work we often hear that chemical addiction referred to as simply a choice. But there are forks in the road that we all kind of run into in our lives in terms of substance use and substance abuse. I think one is typically when we're in the late teens, some unfortunately early when we have choices about whether to use alcohol, how to use alcohol, and other chemicals. The other fork in the road is less of a choice, and it comes to once that decision has been made, what effect it has on us in our lives. And while I think all of us have had the experience of witnessing situations where there's abuse of alcohol and there's abuse of chemicals, we also know that there's only a few of those individuals that end up truly having addiction problems in their lives. And often that, and studies have shown that there's genetic relationships, there's other chemical relationships that move people from abuse to addiction. And so I want to just make that point to this committee because it's often held to a different standard than other diseases.
If I can just interrupt you for a minute, Assistant Commissioner, one of the things that I always like to say to people in when we have this conversation is all of our various addictions have better than a 50% treatment rate. If someone had cancer and they were told they had a 50% chance of receiving successful treatment, we wouldn't consider saying that they couldn't have the treatment. So,
Madam Chair, I'd add another analogy. That would be the issue of diabetic care. We're trying to improve diabetic treatment, not only on the compliance side, but on the treatment side. And I believe that in Minnesota, we're somewhere around 5 or 6% in terms of practitioners providing the appropriate care to diabetics. And certainly the standard of providing effective treatment to people with chemical addiction is much higher than that in the public's eye. And I think it's the same kind of point. It shows you that the public does not yet reflect upon chemical addiction as a disease. It reflects on it more as a lifestyle choice. And there are lifestyle choices that bring you to that disease, but there's a lifestyle choices that bring you to a lot of diseases in the healthcare industry that do not provide that level of scrutiny. But I will say it doesn't hurt to have that scrutiny because in some sense it forces us to look at how do we better deliver chemical health services in a way that is evidence-based, again, that provides best practice and that delivers the best possible patient outcomes that we can. Addiction and its related problems can be treated successfully, but no single treatment works for all substances or for all substance abusers. Because dependency on alcohol and other drugs creates difficulties across an individual's life, just like mental illness creates a difficulty across an individual's life, treatment approaches must address the whole person. Again, here we must bring the healthcare delivery system closer to chemical health treatment, and we need to bring both those systems closer to social services for many of the individuals, not all of the individuals. Our chemical health division has a staff of 24 and is responsible for administrating state policy for substance abuse treatment and prevention. Almost entirely that staff is funded through the federal block grant. So you'll see very little general fund money that is applied to the operations of the Chemical Health Division. We work with tribes, counties, providers, and mental health care programs to implement this policy. The division's the division's operations almost entirely statutory. Most public supported treatment is billed through the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. This is a forecasted state entitlement program that funds roughly 50% of substance abuse treatment services in the state. Currently, this is currently forecasted to support about over 27,000 individuals or treatment placements in fiscal year 2007 at a total cost of around $105 million. This would be $70 million in state share. Currently, the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund funds treatment for persons eligible for Minnesota health care programs, medical assistance, general assistance medical care, but not Minnesota care. As for those for those who are under 100% of the federal poverty guidelines, that eligibility of 100% of the federal poverty guidelines is typically referred to as Tier 1. We have historically had three tiers of funding. Tier 1 was the entitlement portion, and it was applied to people at 100% of poverty or below. Tier 2 was at one time funded up to 215% of poverty, and that was non-entitlement. In other words, it was available to the extent that funds were available. And Tier 3 was for up to 415% of poverty. Tier 2 was last funded in 2003, and Tier 3 was last funded in 1990. So you'll hear references to these tiers, but they have not really received, really the only tier that's been in place for some time has been Tier 1 for those at 100% of poverty and below. But the tiers are still in law, and that's why I reference them here. Counties are the primary gatekeepers to the consolidated fund and services, and they determine eligibility and conduct assessments that guide treatment, placement, and decisions. There are approximately 300 substance abuse providers who operate under county-negotiated service contracts. Outside of the treatment fund, the state also uses state and federal funds to provide treatment supports like case management and aftercare and a variety of substance abuse prevention activities. Our current chemical health priorities include updating statewide approaches to assessment and treatment of substance abuse in order to better meet individual needs, facilitating the adoption of best practices by the state's 300-plus treatment programs, responding to recommendations to recent legislative audit report on substance abuse, addressing the treatment and prevention demands of the methamphetamine problem, providing treatment supports for pregnant women and women with dependent children, meeting the needs of veterans returning from the Middle East, and addressing the chemical health needs of the American Indians through improved approaches to prevention and treatment. Current activities include updating administrative rules to bring more standardization of best practice across the state, to improve assessment practices, individualized treatment planning to address all factors related to successful recovery. In partnership with higher education, we are bringing what is called motivational interviewing training to more than 2,000 chemical dependency counselors. This is an evidence-based practice that uses a series of therapeutic techniques designed to improve the client's resolve for positive change. The Chemical Health Division is also partnering with the Adult Mental Health Division in the development of the integrated dual diagnosis services that I mentioned that we just received a grant for when I was talking about adult mental health. This is for co-occurrence of MI and CD. We are adding treatment provider information to the MinnesotaHelp.info site as a resource to families and counties. We're working with licensing division to place the results of provider licensing reviews and actions on the web. We're developing a substance abuse portion of the Returning Veterans Reintegration Program. We've been working very closely with the chaplain in putting together a program to provide information to returning vets, primarily from the Middle East and Iraq, as part of their reintegration. We are targeting grants to increase state capacity to provide treatment support for pregnant women and children. We're improving the state compliance levels with the federal SINAR requirements, which is our requirements to prevent tobacco sales to minors. With our current, the current SINAR requirement rate is 80%. Minnesota has improved its rate to 90%. So we're well above right now the federal performance requirements on tobacco sales. Our current challenges are redesigning chemical and mental health services through the expansion of treatment designs that rely on evidence-based or best practice, addressing disparities and developing culturally competent age-appropriate treatment designs, developing stronger capacity for measuring and evaluating treatment outcomes, providing effective training that will support all of the above with a particular emphasis on equipping providers with the knowledge they need to effectively deal with the methamphetamine epidemic, and addressing the use of crack cocaine in the African American community. I want to mention on the last, because methamphetamine is certainly a tremendous challenge for this state, there's a very similar challenge occurring among the African American community in crack cocaine. It gets paid less attention to because it's more long-standing. It probably gets paid less attention to because it's in a minority community. But it's just as serious as what we are facing with the methamphetamine problem, and I say that without dismissing that problem in any way, shape, or form. It's just as serious an issue in the African. Crack cocaine is a very serious issue that we're dealing with in the African American community today. That's the overview of chemical health. Again, the pages are found on, I believe, 206.
Right, and the forecasted programs are shown on 202. And one of the things that I'm wondering about, Assistant Commissioner, is we see fairly large forecast adjustment in the current appropriations for the chemical dependency programs. And I'm wondering if you know why that would be happening.
Madam Chair, my understanding is we're seeing fairly significant growth in people who are seeking treatment and are eligible under those programs. I think it's growth in cases primarily. I know that
Commissioner, it's a downward adjustment of on page 202, you know, 7.
I know why.
Okay. We have an answer regardless if I can find it. Find it on the page.
Madam Chair, there was the forecast is forecasted off of trends that are showing up in the data in number of placements and average cost of placements. There was, when the last forecast was prepared at end of session, a large spike right towards the end of the period that the data was drawn from. Indicating an increase. It wasn't clear whether that was going to be an ongoing trend, and so the forecast was adjusted to take kind of a middle road there. That trend has not panned out to the extent that it was that was felt possible at the time that the forecast was put in place at the end of session last year, and so it's now been adjusted back downward to reflect a more general trend.
Madam Chair, but I believe the trend is still upward. It's just not as much growth as what was anticipated in the previous forecast. I think, my recollection is correct, I think it's been growing at a rate of about 7% a year, but I don't have the figures in front of me, so I can get back.
Well, it looks like $3 to $4 million between 06, 07, and 08, and then a larger increase in 09. Okay, other questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Quister, I'm not sure if either one of you can answer this, but is it possible to become a CD, chemical dependency counselor, if you are a felon? Because I'm getting several comments from people saying they would like to become counselors and they can't because they had a drug addiction, and they would be the perfect counselor, of course.
Senator Rosen, you might recall the discussion that we had on the floor last session about
oh, that's right. Yeah.
the set-asides?
Yes. I do remember that, Madam Chair.
So I don't think there's anything in the professional standards that would disallow someone from becoming a chemical dependency counselor. It's in state law that we do not allow a set-aside to be granted. And last session, in spite of the big and heroic effort that we put forward to try to change this for a number of professions, the only thing we were able to get was allowing people who have had set-asides in the past to be given another set-aside in the chemical dependency field if they are treating adults. And so what that did then is it would allow somebody who's in the chemical dependency field and has a license to be able to change jobs. If you have a license, they're not going to take the license away from you. But if you change jobs, then you have to ask for a new set-aside because you are changing employers or you're changing positions or you're moving from one level to another level. Mm-hmm. And that was all that we were able to get. So it definitely is a problem. And it's not only a problem in the field of chemical dependencies, it's a problem in the field of nursing, it's a problem in the field of you name it. Because obviously, oftentimes people have committed a crime in the past due to an addiction that has been overcome. And they have been rehabilitated. And I would say, in my opinion, the current state of our laws does not recognize rehabilitation.
Madam Chair, I would agree with you.
Are there other questions about the chemical dependency pages? Okay. If
Madam
not,
Chair,
let's move on.
I'm going to be moving to state-operated services. I believe that page 218... 218 begins a section on state-operated services. As an overview, state-operated services provides direct care services for persons with disabilities at community-based programs and residences and the remaining regional treatment center programs located throughout the state. State-operated services employs about over 5,000 employees and during fiscal year 2006 served approximately 13,000 clients among all its service lines. State-operated services are funded by a unique blend of direct appropriation for some activities and for other activities. They are enterprise activities, or in other words, their support is based on the revenues that they bring in through the delivery of their services. Appropriated activities are those that the legislature provides state appropriations to finance, and appropriations represent approximately 69% of the funding for all state-operated services. The remaining 31% of the funding for state-operated services are these revenue-based programs, and they are often done through contracts with counties, and billings are often done through program services such as home and community-based waiver that's funded through the medical assistance account. The future of state-operated services is changing dramatically. We are opening, as I mentioned, 10 community-based behavioral health hospitals. 7 have already opened, 3 more to open by the end of the summer. We have recently closed or in the process of closing all non-forensics adult mental health units at St. Peter, Fergus Falls, Brainerd, and Wilmer. I might mention that all these communities have been involved in a local process for determining the reuse of those campuses. Well, the Wilmer campus has been sold. The Fergus Falls campus is in the process of being partially sold. And there are active community groups working on Brainerd, as I'm sure Senator Coring is aware of, and with the Agua Ching campus. We are moving the forensic nursing home services from Agua Ching to a new 50-bed facility being built at the St. Peter campus, allowing us to close the Agua Ching program and campus, and we are building a 400-bed sex offender facility in Moose Lake that will save money and allow us to consolidate the sex offender program in one location and separate this program from the security hospital campus in St. Peter that now serves also serves people committed as mentally ill and dangerous. The first area I will be referring specifically to is referenced on page 220, and it's State Operated Services Mental Health Services. Let me point out that this covers all the mental health services units that are appropriated in state-operated services, except for those that are provided to people who are committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous. They're in a separate budget activity. So when I refer to mental health services, I'm referring to the non-forensic mental health services, if you will. And I will talk about the services to people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous later in this discussion. This budget activity, again, supports mental health services provided by state-operated services that are funded through a direct appropriation. This includes regional treatment centers, community-based inpatient programs, community-based crisis programs, state adult mental health initiative staff. We have staff assigned to counties to provide the help in the provision of community-based services for which we receive appropriations for. And this also covers the system-wide operation accounts. So when you see a fairly significant number of operation staff in here, this is the operation staff that not only covers these mental health services, but also covers the sex offender services, covers the MIND population, and all the enterprise services that are not billed for directly. Our recent restructuring of Minnesota Mental Health Services has significantly changed the state role in directly providing treatment and care to people with mental illness. In 1980, nearly 1,400 mental health patients resided in 7 regional treatment centers. Today, we have 200 patients in our regional treatment centers, with the vast majority of these patients residing in Anoka. I believe 180 of them, approximately, are in Anoka. Over the past year, the St. Peter campus and the Fergus Falls campus have closed. The Wilmer and Brainerd campuses have very few patients remaining and are expected to close all mental health units by this summer. This dramatic reduction in reliance on institutional care models such as regional treatment centers was made possible, as I said before, through the development of community-based services. This development includes both the expansion of community support services that I talked about in adult mental health and children's mental health, but it also includes the development of those 10 hospital sites that are dispersed throughout greater Minnesota. Services provided in these hospitals, new hospitals, emphasize modern evidence-based treatment modalities, and I've already talked about the improvements in performance, and I've certainly heard Senator Olson's comments about how to best measure performance. In addition to these hospitals, the state operates mental health crisis beds in both Mankato and Duluth. Mental health inpatient services will continue to be provided on the Brainerd Regional Treatment Center campus and at the Wilmer Regional Treatment Center campus until the Bemidji, Cold Spring, and Wilmer Behavioral Health Hospitals are finally built. So we continue to have a mental health presence on those campuses until the community mental health hospitals are finally built in their surrounding area. I'll also mention again that we may have a continuing presence on those campuses with some of our other programs, but this will be determined on, to a great extent, on the local planning that's being done on the reuse of those facilities.
Madam Chair, if I could ask a question at this point.
Yes, Senator Coring.
Assistant Commissioner, let's say a year down the road, are you going to measure the amount of beds that are needed? Like, let's say Brainerd, for example, 16 beds. Is the department going to be measuring to see if that's an adequate amount? And then if it is not an adequate amount, do you have plans in place to maybe build another 16-bed unit there, or maybe in Bemidji or Wadena or whatever? Are you going to be monitoring so that we don't have, like Senator Sharon said, what I was told is these 16-bed units, like, for example, Wadena, and I understand that they're very happy about having a unit there. They don't have to pick somebody from out of their community and take them somewhere else. But if we're taking somebody from Brainerd down to Mankato, we got to make sure we have enough beds right where we're at. So are you going to be monitoring that, or is that going to be something that will be in the future plans? Does that make sense?
Madam Chair, Senator Coring, there's no plans to to add additional hospitals at this point. I think, of course, we're going to be constantly looking at the service capacity. I think the bed tracking system will help us do that. Let me mention what we've discovered with the hospitals that have opened so far in the areas where the mental health units have closed in the regional treatment centers. And that is that because the average length of stay was even less than what was projected, and that we are now making those units available to a limited extent to the outer ring counties in the metro area. It's because while they have a capacity of 16, in some cases their success, and by the way, their success is in part determined by what's happening in community services in those areas as well. Okay. Their success has resulted in some bed availability, and so the original fears were that it may not be enough. Mm-hmm. Now we're finding that we can relieve some of the pressure from Anoka by, for example, allowing Dakota County to access Rochester, by allowing Scott County to access the St. Peter Hospital, and so forth. So far, experiences has told us that it's good. Okay. And that we're pretty close. And, in fact, to the point where we've been able to open access to parts of the state that we didn't think would be part of the catchment area of those hospitals. I can't, you know, obviously Brainerd is a situation of itself, and we're going to have to look at Brainerd closely as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner, has there been any thought given to the idea of creating 16-bed units in the metro area to replace beds at Anoka?
Madam Chair, we've not proposed that. We've had conversations that counties have initiated because they've seen the success of what was going on in those behavioral health hospitals. They're, of course, interested because they provide a good service. By the way, we've gotten very good feedback on quality from both consumers and payers with respect to those services. And it's more efficient in terms of drawing federal revenues. As you mentioned earlier, we cannot draw federal revenues for the Anoka facility, and we can for the 16-bed facility as a result of federal regulations that I will spare you from today. So there is an interest. There's an interest both in terms of its billing efficiency. We're also seeing an interest in terms of having something closer to their community than Anoka might be. But we were able to do this in the greater Minnesota, outstate Minnesota, by moving resources that were once appropriated to those facilities to these facilities and managing the timing of that transition very closely. We did not get new money to do this. And so this really takes the cooperation of a lot of parties, including the communities, the state, the counties, the workers, and so forth. It's a very difficult process to put in place and finish off, but I think the potential is really one that we need to look at.
So you've been thinking about it, but you haven't been talking about it. Is that kind of what I got?
Well,
we've
had some of the counties, like Dakota and others, express an interest in developing a 16-bed unit there. And, of course, that means we have to have financing available to do that. Well, the way we were able to do it in outstate Minnesota was moving appropriations that were for regional treatment center units to the community-based hospitals. And given where we're at with hospital bed issues in the metro area, it's a little bit of a trickier situation. But I think it's something that's worth discussing.
I also think there needs to be more discussion about it. Are you finished with these pages?
Well, I could be if you would like me to, Madam Chair.
We're not trying to hurry you along.
I
thought you got interrupted, but I wasn't sure.
I need to move to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. I believe that is found on page.
Just before you do that, are there any more questions about the pages that are in regard to our state-operated mental health services?
Madam Chair, I just can't not ask this question. Yeah, I want to preface it by saying I think that you're doing a great job with the resources that you're trying to manage that in a system that has a lot of discriminatory attitudes toward it. And you may not be able to answer this right now, but I would wonder in terms of other illnesses such as that require acute care, such as renal dialysis or, treatment for ongoing treatment for cancer, if you are tracking how many of those patients are being transported to other communities, Mankato to Duluth or Duluth to Rochester in order to receive their care.
Madam Chair, I don't have the answer to that, but I'll see if there's
some. It's more of a rhetorical question. It's pointing out the discriminatory approach to mental health care as opposed to other kinds of care.
And again, Senator Sharon, if you look at the Medicare payments, you'll find they're pretty lucrative in the area of cancer and heart, right, and not so good in the area of mental health.
That's right.
Okay, then let's go on.
Madam Chair, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program discussion begins on page 223. This program is operated at the Department of Human Services Moose Lake campus. We also have a presence currently in the Department of Corrections Moose Lake Correctional Campus and the Department of Human Services St. Peter Campus. These services, again, are funded through a direct appropriation. Individuals are referred to the sex offender program through the civil commitment process, with the majority of our sex offender patients directly referred to commitment from the Department of Corrections. I should also mention that patients are released through the civil commitment process as well and through the court system. Since a 2003 policy change that resulted in the referral of all Level 3 sex offenders to civil commitment, the Minnesota Sex Offender Program has experienced unprecedented growth. Currently, there are approximately 350 patients being treated in this program. Last session, growth was projected to be about 58 per year, and significant funding was added to support the demand for treatment units and staff. I should mention here, prior to 2003, we were seeing a growth in patients of somewhere between 15 and 18 per year. So it has at least tripled and almost quadrupled in annual growth. In addition, to address this unprecedented growth, the 2006 legislature passed a $41 million bonding package to build a 400-bed facility at the existing DHS Moose Lake campus to accommodate this growth. This facility is expected to be completed in October of 2008. This will allow us to consolidate the sex offender program on the Moose Lake campus. That means we will no longer have a primary treatment program in St. Peter or have to use the temporary corrections campus to treat and house these patients. I will also mention that building will allow us to reduce cost per patient, because right now our treatment is provided in hospitals that are not designed for security emphasis like we need with these patients. And so this is a much different facility based upon corrections designs. We will be serving patients that will be in 80-person wings rather than 25-person units, and we'll be able to fairly significantly reduce our per-patient costs. And I think that shows itself in the budget, on the budget pages. Still, it's an expensive program. I don't want to imply otherwise.
Again, it reminds me a little bit of the signs I used to have in the grocery stores that implied that if you bought your groceries with a credit card, you would save more money. We might be serving people at a lower per-person cost, but we're serving so many more people that we can hardly call it a savings.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
In fact, if I might just go on, since I feel pretty strongly about this, if you look at the investment that's been made in the mental health budget of the state of Minnesota, and if you believe that people put their money where their concern is, then you would have to conclude that the only people that we're concerned about in the state of Minnesota are sex offenders, if you look at the last 4 years.
Madam Chair, the facility is expected to be completed in the October of 2008, and at that time we'll begin the consolidation of those programs. I mentioned the more efficient operations that we have. Also have current initiatives that include the development of a more robust vocational program that you've been encouraging for a number of years, and continued improvements to security and patient programs. Part of those improvements is a very active investigation unit where we're trying to rid the treatment environment of any illegal activity. Understand that we serve 350 sex offender patients who have primarily been referred by the Department of Corrections. I believe this is 350 of a total of around 15,000 approximately registered sex offenders. So let's say we're serving maybe 2%, 2.5% of all registered sex offenders in this program. That should be suggestive that we are serving the most difficult to serve, and frankly, the most difficult of the Department of Corrections former inmates. So we have a very difficult population to deal with here, a very challenging population in terms of treatment success, and a very challenging population in terms of security. And one of our approaches is to have zero tolerance in any activity that is not conducive to a treatment environment. And we have a number of active investigations going on all the time. We work very closely with the Department of Corrections, and we work very closely with local county attorneys in prosecuting any illegal activity that occurs in those programs. As I mentioned, we enjoy a strong working relationship with the Department of Corrections, not only in regard to sharing space on their Moose Lake Correction site, but also in assistance with improvements to security and general operations, and I would also say with assistance in terms of the design of the new facility that we're building. We built this facility so that it would not only work for the Department of Human Services, but if there were a time that we did not need it and Corrections did, that would be a facility they would welcome using, as opposed to some of the other facilities we have transferred to the Department of Corrections in the past. That's the last of my comments on the sex offender program.
Assistant Commissioner, you had indicated to me, at least, that the productive day program at the sex offender program in the sex offender program would begin in January of this year. I'm wondering what type of work we're anticipating beginning them to be involved in.
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'll ask Mike Tesner to talk a little more specifically about.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Tesner. I'm the Chief Executive for State Operated Services. The development of the work services within the Minnesota Sex Offender Program began with hiring a new director. That new director is on board now and is in the process of designing the transition from what was mostly sheltered workshop type activities, refinishing furniture, making birdhouses, to light industry. So that process has begun. Once we get the design, we will be implementing that light industry model that Corrections uses, the MinCorps Industries uses.
But do you know what type of employment services that the new director is looking at to begin with?
Madam Chair, we are looking at, we'll actually be operating somewhat like a subsidiary of MinCorps Industries. So we will be taking some of their piecework, which could include assembling electronics, assembling fish lures, piecework mostly that factories farm out to the Department of Corrections. So it's that type of activity that we're looking at.
And what wage do you expect that the people participating in the program would be earning?
Madam Chair, it would be a commensurate wage. So it would be if the industry were out in the community and it was a $7 an hour job, then that's what the folks in the program would be paid.
And do you have plans for then people who are in the program to be contributing some of their earnings toward the cost of their care?
Madam Chair, the current requirement is that the patients participate in the cost of care of the program, so they essentially are billed on a monthly basis. In the case of work services, what we would anticipate is that they would have a payroll deduction for that cost of care.
And have you anticipated how much revenue over the next biennium might be generated through this activity?
Madam Chair, I think we've done some rough calculations. I don't have those this morning. We can get those to you.
Thank you. Are there other questions about the sex offender services? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, just to follow up perhaps a little on the chairman's point, could you tell me statistically what the likelihood of recovery or rehabilitation is for sex offenders as compared to the recovery statistics for people with mental illness?
Madam Chair, I don't have the statistics with me. I can see if there's any studies available that
Well, the question I'm asking, without, if you don't have the exact numbers, would it be fair to say that the general population that suffers from either mental illness or addiction issues are statistically much more likely to be to have successful treatment results, or the money that we spend on treating them statistically likely to be providing, allowing them to lead a normal and healthy life, as compared to statistically the percentage of people who are sex offenders of the level that you're treating in terms of their success rate for rehabilitation or amenability to treatment? I guess I'm not asking that question very well, but I think you know what I'm talking about.
Madam Chair, I certainly get the point. And
Senator Olson, I think part of the difficulty of answering this question is that it depends which group you're talking about. As Commissioner Koistra has said, 98% of our sex offenders are not in the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. They are returning to the community, and they are under the charge and under the supervision of the Department of Corrections. So Assistant Commissioner Koistra wouldn't have that information unless he could get it from the Department of Corrections. I think for the group of people that we have in our Minnesota Sex Offender Program, we can tell you that only one has ever been released, and that individual was returned back to the program. But I can also tell you that I have hope that in the future we will have more releases, because we are now referring virtually all level threes into this program. And in the past, we had the majority of level threes going back to the community, and most of them were succeeding. So it would indicate to me that the new level threes coming into the system should be more amenable to treatment than the level threes maybe that we've had in the past. Other questions? Commissioner, I have just a couple of questions. You remember the conversation that we had earlier in this year about property that had been removed from the residents of this program that was in storage somewhere? Do you know if that issue has been resolved yet?
Madam Chair, the issue that was raised, there was a security incident that occurred last summer that required us to go through the program essentially room by room to look at people's personal possessions, searching out contraband. In that process, what it was determined was a number of the patients had exceeded their property limits, and we therefore enforced the property limits, taking that property, inventorying it, and storing it for them. We are now
property limits.
Madam Chair, depending on where the patient is in the program, there are certain property limits that they have to live within. So they can't have unlimited property. For example, they couldn't have a piano. They can't have more than a certain...
Well, I doubt anybody had a piano.
Madam Chair, actually one patient did have a piano, and it was stored on the campus. It's now been removed. But the issue is how much clothing they have, how much electronic equipment they have, how much books and reading materials. Some individuals, if there weren't limits, you wouldn't be able to get into their room. So,
well, I understand that, but I also know that computers, for example, were removed from residence and placed in storage, and nobody has any idea what's happening to this property. one of the latest versions that I heard of it was they were going to have to mail this property back to their families or to people that are friends of theirs, and then those people were going to have to mail it back to them. And
Madam Chair,
I think there's a concern that the longer we go without resolving these issues, that this property will become lost or damaged or stolen by people who are not in the program.
Madam Chair, look, I think your question's fair. We'll get back to you with an update on where we're at with that issue. I do want to say that we have had a lot of security issues surrounding property and the use of property for purposes that are in conflict with the security there. It's a very difficult issue to balance in a treatment setting. This is a hospital. Our obligation is to provide treatment. But everyone understands our obligation is also to provide security. And we are constantly trying to find that balance. For example, in the use of computers, there was a lot of illegal activity occurring with the use of computers. There's been with the issue of clutter in the rooms. Clutter in the rooms prevents security checks from being done, and we're constantly in that balance. But part of that balance is respectful treatment of patients, and I think that's the point you're trying to make. And we'll get back to
Commissioner, I can understand a person that might not be allowed to have internet access for their computer, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't necessarily be allowed to have the possession of a computer. A computer can be used for more things than accessing the internet. There was a second question that I had asked of you also, and that was in regard to families who are trying to visit their patient, their family members who are patients, who were not able to be able to see their loved one because somehow or another the visitation schedule was not being managed properly. So we had family members coming and waiting for 2 hours and not ever being able to get in to see their family member. Has anything been done to resolve that issue?
Madam Chair, the visitation hours are posted. I think the problem erupted around when we opened the new services in the annex. There was some confusion about how visitation was going to happen in the annex building. I think that's been resolved. But the hours are posted. The patients know when they are. It's essentially 7 days a week, more on weekends than weekdays. And it starts, in the morning and goes till early evening. So I'm not aware that since the initial problems in the annex occurred that has reoccurred.
So when family members come to visit their loved ones, they are all able to visit with their loved ones on the day they come. No one's being turned away and being sent back home after their 100 or 200-mile drive without having a chance to visit.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware that that's occurring, no.
If you could make sure of that and get back to me, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you brought up a very good point, and I, too, had an issue with a constituent who had some issues with the St. Peter. They have a son that's in St. Peter. And I struggled on the process of how do you even go to even form a complaint. Who do you complain to?
Mm-hmm.
How do you get an answer? And it was very, very frustrating. And there was issues with property that was missing in the facility itself and or monies that were missing. And to take it even farther, for going down this path, that treatment was never even brought up. So that he's in there and he's not receiving treatment. So how do you even go to even find out how this can be rectified and get an answer? That's my question. It's a very simple question.
Senator Rosen, I understand your frustration. It is, let me put it this way. I have a list of things for this program to answer questions about, and I am giving them to them two at a time. And so I thought maybe today we would have the first two resolved, and it doesn't sound like we quite have the first two resolved. So But this is on the list. Not only is it difficult for family members to get answers to questions or to resolve disagreements or issues that they have, no one seems to be able to get their issues answered or resolved in a timely fashion, in spite of the fact that the program has now designated an individual whose full-time responsibilities are to answer these questions. So it's on the list, but I haven't given it to the department yet because I've been waiting for the first two questions to get answered.
So, Madam Chair, a point of contact.
Yes. Could you give that point of contact to Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, we'll give it to Senator Rosen and share with the other members of the committee as well.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, if not, let's move on.
Madam Chair, the next area is the Minnesota Security Hospital, which is, and the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program found on page 225. The services provided by the Minnesota Security Hospital at St. Peter and the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program at Cambridge and the Forensics Nursing Home at Agua, Ching, and Walker represent the remaining services funded, separated services funded through direct appropriations. The Security Hospital is a secure treatment facility located in St. Peter that provides multidisciplinary forensic treatment services to approximately 225 individuals who are under civil commitment as mentally ill and dangerous. The Security Hospital also provides court-ordered forensics evaluations, including competency to stand trial and pre-sentence mental health evaluations. If you've heard of cases or read of cases in the newspaper that are high-profile competency issues, chances are they've received court-ordered forensic evaluations in our program. The Security Hospital has also experienced significant patient growth. Again, this seemed to line up with the policy change for sex offenders that seemed to also create a change in admissions and reduction in discharges for persons committed as mentally ill and dangerous. They are two entirely separate populations. I want to emphasize that. At one time, patient growth in the Security Hospital was at an average of 5 patients per year. Recently, the growth climbed to 25 per year, and now we forecast growth at approximately 19 per year. So it's still, again, almost quadruple what it was prior to the change in policy for sex offenders. I think this reflects more caution on the part of county attorneys, on the part of local counties in terms of people who may present some threat or danger to the public, but we also believe that there are many of these individuals who can live successfully in the community because with respect to people who are committed as mentally ill and dangerous, their issues are mental illness related, episodic, and certainly treatable to a great extent. You'll see a budget page this year on this piece because we were earlier projecting growth of 25 per year, and the budget page will reflect the reduction in our forecasted growth for this population. The Forensics Nursing Facility in Agua Ching campus near Walker currently serves about 25 patients per year. These are people who are committed as sex offenders, committed as mentally ill and dangerous, or often referred to us by the Department of Corrections in terms of inmates who need nursing home care. This service will move to a 50-bed facility being constructed on the St. Peter's campus, and this is scheduled for completion late in the summer of 2008. The Forensics Nursing Facility serves clients in need of nursing home care, as I mentioned, and I already mentioned where they've come from. The Minnesota Extended Treatment Option Program is referred to as the MEDO program in Cambridge, is a 48-bed specialized service for individuals with disabilities whose behaviors present a public safety risk. These tend to be people who have a disability, often borderline developmental disability, may not meet the definition of developmental disability for federal purposes, but certainly have developmental delays or other disabilities and present a risk to the public. The focus of this treatment in this program is on changing client behavior and identifying necessary supports that will permit their return to community. The MEDO program also utilizes teams of individuals working for community support services in order to enhance community capacity for these individuals who may be at risk of being committed to MEDO. So that that's a general description of the programs that are this budget activity, Madam Chair.
And how are we doing in terms of people committed as mentally ill and dangerous in terms of their release? How many per year are we releasing now, and what do we anticipate that will be in the future?
Madam Chair, if you recall last session, we had gone an entire year with no one being discharged. This past year, I think that number is somewhere around 6 to 8. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but we have seen an increase in people leaving the transition service, which is on the campus of St. Peter, and going on provisional discharge status back to the community. Last session, we also got the flexibility of developing a new level of care in the community that the state will actually develop. There's a working group now pulling together what that model will look like, and we're anticipating summer or early fall having those residential services, a new level of care, if you will, established in the community that will presumably be available to the population leaving the campus.
And so what is the projection then on the number of people per year leaving the program for the future?
Well, Madam Chair, that's a little difficult. Typically, prior to last year when we had none, that number was somewhere around 13, 15 per year. This past year, as I said, I think it was running about 6 to 8, so we're about half what it typically had been. We certainly would expect to get back up to that 13 to 15 range.
I would hope so, too. I'm just wondering if it's going to happen during the biennium that we're going to be budgeting for.
Madam Chair, we expect the services that we will be operating to be up and running during this calendar year, late, as I said, summer, early fall. That will provide an opportunity for people to be placed. But as you're well aware, the actual placement is out of the hands of us as a provider.
Well, we'd like to get more information on what you're projecting in that area. And what is the length of stay for people in the MEDO program?
Madam Chair, the average length of stay runs probably 13 to 15 months, so a year, year and a half.
And have you seen any change in that length of stay over the last few years?
Madam Chair, not over the last few years. It's been pretty consistent.
And have you seen an increase in the number of people being referred to that program?
Madam Chair, yes, we have. Historically, the program up until last year ran a census of somewhere between 25 to 35, depending. And at this point, we've been running pretty consistently in the low 40s. It's a 48-bed program, and if we're running 40, 42, we're pretty much full.
And do you are you projecting to continue to see that level of need for enrollment in this program?
Madam Chair, we have not seen a decrease in the referrals that started about a year ago. Whatever the change was that caused county attorneys to make those referrals and or petitions and civil commitment orders seems to be sustaining itself. We have, if you'll recall, expanded our community support service function to make sure that if there's a safe and effective way to keep the person in the community, that resources are brought to bear there. And frankly, we've diverted a number of individuals from the civil commitment process and admission into MEDO. But that's another reason why we don't see at this point any lessening of that pressure.
Okay, thank you. And then when the forensic nursing home changes its campus, are you anticipating any increase in staffing?
Madam Chair, no, we're not. The current budget up at Agua Ching would simply be transferred down to the operation at St. Peter.
And would the current budget serve the same number of people at a different campus?
Madam Chair, that's what we're projecting.
I thought that part of the reason for wanting to change campuses was so there could be more efficient operations.
Madam Chair, the construction of the new building or the nursing home and its the space necessary to build it on the Agua Chin campus would have been substantially higher. The operational costs at Agua Chin now, we're projecting, would be transferred down to St. Peter.
And there would be no efficiencies gained?
Madam Chair, I do not believe so at this time.
Okay, well, I think we'd like to look into that issue a little further also. Are there any other questions on this page? Okay, if not, let's keep going.
Madam Chair, the final section is the State Operated Services Enterprise Services that is found on page 230. And just very briefly, again, enterprise services are services that are revenue-based, supported by the revenues they generate, or market-based services that are generally provided through contract with counties. There are also some private payers for these services. They include approximately 120 community-based residential programs for persons with developmental disabilities, 19-day training and rehabilitation programs for persons with developmental disabilities, 6 chemical addiction recovery programs, the Minnesota Neuro Rehabilitation Service Program located on the Brainerd campus serving people with brain injury, and the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services Program, providing services at 14 sites that range from in-home crisis intervention to acute inpatient hospital care. The acute beds are located currently at Wilmer and Brainerd. Many of these programs were developed in context with the closure of developmental disabilities programs in the regional treatment centers, so there's some historical context to this. Others are there because there are no private providers willing to provide the service or able in some cases.
And Assistant Commissioner, I see that there's just a small growth from 06 to 07 in the revenues of this program, which are earned revenues, and then it flattens out. Do you know what the reason would be for it flattening out if it's experiencing a small growth?
Madam Chair, if I can, I'd like to get back to you on that. Thank you.
Other questions on this page? If not, we thank you for your presentation today, and we look forward to continuing to work with this part of the department as we move forward to continually improve the services. And so with that, our meeting will be adjourned. I just need to announce to the members here today that our meeting tomorrow will only run until 10 a.m. because there has been a caucus called for 10 a.m. prior to session. So for the minority members, if you are behind on your appointments, you get another hour to meet with people.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
With that, the meeting will be adjourned.